From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. All over the country, Latinos are graduating from college this month, so today our program is devoted to them and some advice from Latino grads who have been there, done that.
To not be afraid to pursue your passions, but to also know that that path to that career goal doesn't necessarily look only one specific way.
Plus, a Supreme Court ruling on race and college admissions could affect thousands of college-bound students.
The population is growing, yet the student bodies are getting smaller and smaller in terms of the minority populations.
And everyone talks about guest workers along with immigration reform. We hear from the OGs, the original guest workers, braceros, now fighting for what they're owed after half a century.
The braceros say that the government stole that money, but we don't know because it's been so long.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Over these few weeks, more than 1.7 million students will receive college diplomas. So what if you're a Latino graduate? Are things any different for you? Better because you're bilingual or worse because you're an immigrant? We reached out and got some real life stories from Latinos who graduated over the past couple of years. Stories of amazing challenges and cool opportunities, as long as you're willing to not give up after college.
My name is Sergio. I graduated from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I am 24 years old. I am the first in my family to go to college. And I was an English major. At the time, it was not as well publicized to have undocumented students in the university. So I was one of two, maybe three at the time. It was a big secret for everybody. I keep my diploma in the closet. I don't even show it out. I'm proud to have gone to school and everything, but I haven't been able to use my education for job purposes. Having been undocumented for now 15 years, I see many people graduate from college, but I've yet to meet really anyone who has a very good job in that style. So I didn't bother to try. I have applied for my deferred action. I am waiting, should hopefully come by this month or next month, actually. I hope to be able to find a much better job and leave the restaurant business behind. I would like to teach eventually. I would like to work at a bank or something along those lines, something where it's a little bit easier than what I do now. Look for a job that makes you happy. Even if it's not a great job, if it makes you happy, it's a lot better than anything.
I'm Georgina Leal. I graduated with a BA in Latin American Studies and Anthropology from DePaul University in 2012. The understanding that I had of college was very narrow in the sense that I thought it was just about going to college to get a better job, to be paid better. But I think one of the things that I learned was that I could follow my passions and then I could do something that I really enjoyed and also be better off. I actually decided to pursue a year of service through AmeriCorps. Through that program, I'm working at a worksite in a clinic called Casa de Salud, and I'm working with Latino immigrants. It's also been an experience that's motivated even more to kind of follow my career goal, which is to pursue a PhD in anthropology. I think my parents, in seeing the opportunities that have opened up for me because of college, they just feel like they're living vicariously through me and that, you know, my success is their success. The advice that I would give the class of 2013 is, you know, to not be afraid to pursue your passions, but to also know that that path to that career goal or that life goal doesn't necessarily look only one specific way.
My name is Jason. I'm 24 years old, and I actually graduated in 2012 with a bachelor's degree in business administration and with a concentration in management. I had a full scholarship, so I didn't owe any money to anyone. So I was like free of debt. It helped a lot, to be honest, because the majority of people in the US that get out of college, they have a lot of debt. I was the first one to get a degree from a university. In my family, That year at the beginning was really hard for me because I thought that if I went to school and I got a degree, I was going to be able to probably get a legal status in the U.S. But I guess I was wrong. And I also thought that even if I didn't have legal status in the U.S., I was going to be able to find a good job because of my education, the degree that I got. A lot of my friends got really good jobs, but I didn't have that opportunity. I have to work 1 year for a painting company. And now that I apply for deferred action and I got my legal status for 2 years, I had the opportunity to accept the job offer from UNC Healthcare. I'm going to be in the urology department. I'm going to be an administrative associate there. I think that's a good starting point. The first thing that I would advise is to get really good grades in school. Even if you're not legal in the U.S., I know that there are some schools that are willing to help. There's always a door open. In the end, if you do the right thing, then you will find it.
That was Sergio in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Gina Leal in St. Louis, Missouri, and Jason in Pittsboro, North Carolina. The narrative around Latinos and education always revolves around the number of Latino dropouts. Well, last month, the Pew Hispanic Center made headlines when a recent poll showed a big rise in the number of young Latino high school grads enrolling in college. Nearly 7 in 10 from the class of 2012 enrolled in either 2 or 4 year colleges. And here's the other headline. The number of Latino grads going on to college has now surpassed the percentage of white teens going straight from high school to college. To put these numbers into perspective, we're joined by Richard Fry. He's a senior research associate at the Pew Research Hispanic Center, and he co-authored this study. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Latino USA, Richard.
Delighted to be with you.
This is great news. How do you explain this rise in Latino college enrollment when usually the numbers are pretty dismal?
I think that there's been a lot of hard effort of Latino educators and the Latino community to get the high school graduates prepared. There's evidence that parental attitudes towards education versus work have changed and that Latino parents do place a lot of emphasis now on the schooling and college going of young Latinos. They live in states that have been harder hit by the nation's housing bust. And so some of this extra Latino college going may reflect the difficult job market.
All right. So what kinds of colleges are Latinos enrolling into? Are these four-year programs? Are they mostly community colleges? And does this matter for the job market when you're a Latino graduate?
They disproportionately tend to go to community colleges. Then they have to transfer. And that path through higher education to getting a bachelor's degree, it's just a more difficult pathway. And so, yes, where you go matters because it very much influences whether you're going to have that associate's degree and bachelor's degree a few years down the road.
Are Latinos, in fact, keeping up with other students when it comes to actually finishing, completing college, and graduating?
No, they are not. And just to sort of put some numbers on it, suppose we look at undergraduates that start in a four-year institution. 6 years later, 62% of whites will have a bachelor's degree, 69% of Asians will have a bachelor's degree, but only 51% of young Latinos that start at a four-year institution will have a bachelor's degree 6 years later. And so this is why last month's Pew report needs to be kept in context. Yes, it's great that Latino college going has now matched with white college going. But what's really important for the labor market is actually completing a college degree. And young Latinos still remain significantly behind in actually finishing post-secondary degrees.
So a tough economy, unemployment is still high. So does it pay off for Latinos to get that college degree in terms of the job market?
On average, it clearly does. And I just want to sort of put some context. How important is it? Suppose we're looking at a young Latino male. If he completes a bachelor's degree and no advanced education, we would typically expect him to make about $2.1 million over his career. Alternatively, suppose he stops his education at high school graduation. then we'd expect him to make about $1.3 million over his work life. So what's the typical average expected payoff to getting that bachelor's degree? It's an $800,000 for a young Latina. The numbers are slightly different, but the payoff from getting a bachelor's degree is about an extra $700,000. Now, it varies depending on what you major in college, et cetera, et cetera. And these are averages. But yes, it's still, in spite of sort of the nation's recession and the weak job market, in the long run, when we do these kinds of projections of lifetime earnings, we would expect for the typical young Latino a bachelor's degree to strongly pay off.
Richard, thanks so much for all the research that you've done on this. We really appreciate it.
You are very welcome.
Richard Fry is a senior research associate at the Pew Research Hispanic Center. He joined us from the Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C. So, if you need a college degree in order to reach your maximum potential, not only in terms of making the most money, but reaching your own professional high point, what happens if you can't get into college to begin with? And how important is affirmative action in that first step of college, the admissions process? A case before the Supreme Court could change the way schools consider race as a factor in admissions. Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin was argued before the Supreme Court last fall, and a decision is expected any day now. The case was filed by Abigail Fisher, a young white woman who was denied admission to the university, even though, she says, less qualified students of color were accepted. We spoke to Angelo Anchetta about the case. He's a law professor at Santa Clara University in California and was counsel for a friend of the court brief filed in the case by the American Educational Research Association.
In Texas, they have multiple admissions policies. They have what's known as a percent plan, which is a plan that guarantees admission to the top, roughly 10% of the top graduates from the Texas high schools. But they also look at other factors like race, like ethnicity. They also look at the person's background or experiences as well. And she's challenging that policy because she feels that, well, that consideration of race, even though the Supreme Court, at least in 2003, upheld the use of race in admissions, that policy is unconstitutional.
Anchetta believes that the percent plan has managed to draw a good amount of Latino and African-American kids from Texas high schools. But he says it's still critical to have a race-conscious admissions policy for students who aren't among that top 10%.
When looking at the Latino population, whether it's Texas, California, other states with significant population, the numbers are growing in big ways. And if you're looking at the numbers where they have actually declined after you've taken away race-conscious admissions, then you're inevitably dealing with some problems because the population is growing, yet the student bodies are getting smaller and smaller in terms of the minority populations.
A decision on the case is expected at the end of June. And Anchetta says the outcome might have significant impact on Latino enrollment in Texas and nationwide.
We could expect that a lot of public universities, private universities as well, because they're going to be affected by this decision, are going to scale back. They're going to try to achieve minority admission or have minority students in their student bodies, but they're going to have to go about it in other ways. And it's going to be a lot harder for universities to actually do that.
Law professor Angelo Anchetta teaches at Santa Clara University in California. And coming up on Latino USA, maybe your father or grandfather was a bracero. The original guest workers are now in their 70s and 80s, and they have stories to tell. That's coming up. No se vayan. Thank you. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Some talk about guest workers as the solution to the immigration issue. Critics say using people only for their labor and then sending them home is un-American. One of the oldest guest worker programs in U.S. history was that of the Braceros. Nearly 5 million Mexican laborers worked in U.S. fields from 1942 to 1964. Monica Ortiz Uribe is with the Fronteras Changing America desk, and she reports that the guest workers of the past still have many unresolved issues, like getting paid what is due to them.
¿Qué quieren los braceros?
¡Justicia!
¿Cuánto?
Here in this downtown plaza in the Mexican border city of Juarez, dozens of angry men gather every Sunday. They were among the first guest workers to come to the United States back during World War II, when American farm boys traded their plows for rifles.
Algodón, betabel, zanahoria.
Amado Estrada Piñon was 18 when he came to the U.S. to pick carrots, beets, and cotton for 50 cents an hour. That's more than what he was making farming in his native Mexican village. Today, at age 80, his sage-colored eyes are coated with a hazy film, and his skin is toasted and wrinkled. He still wears a rancher's hat and an embroidered leather belt, typical of Mexican cowboys.
Trabajando honradamente.
Estrada and his fellow laborers were called braceros, Spanish for strong arms, because of the physically demanding labor they did. We worked honorably, he says, but the Mexican government was not honorable to us. Part of their paycheck went to a Mexican savings account that the braceros were supposed to get back as pension money. That never happened.
The money disappeared back in the 50s.
Carlos Marentes is the director of the Border Farm Workers Association in neighboring El Paso, Texas.
Well, the braceros say that the government stole that money. But we don't know because it's been so long.
A 2002 investigation by the Dallas Morning News suggests that the Mexican bank in charge of holding the money used it instead for day-to-day operations. In 2005, Mexico agreed to make a one-time payment of about $3,800 to those braceros who could show written proof that they participated in the program. But the government has been slow to distribute the money. Marentes estimates that out of 10,000 braceros in this region who can prove their participation, only 2,000 have received checks so far.
¿Por qué no nos lo entrega?
Why doesn't the government give us our money, says Estrada, the ex-bracero in Juarez. It's ours. We earned it off the sweat of our brows. This is the reason they gather every Sunday to protest in the plaza. As old as they are, there's no such thing as retirement. Most, like Estrada, struggle to make ends meet.
¿Ahorita sabe cuál es mi trabajo?
You know what my job is now, Estrada says, collecting cans off the street like a vagrant at my age. Others sell food and use clothing from their homes. The luckier ones rely on support from their children. At each protest in Juarez, volunteer nurse Blanca Duran takes vital signs on a park bench. Some of her patients are the widows of former braceros. Most can't afford their own health care, so Duran helps by donating medicine.
De hecho, pues se nos van muriendo y hemos visto que se nos van muriendo y sin ninguna ayuda.
They worked so hard for so long, she says, and now many are dying without ever receiving the compensation they're owed. For Latino USA, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe, reporting from Ciudad Juarez, Mexico.
Think of the U.S.-Mexico border, and you think of the land and the wall. But in the Pacific Ocean, at Imperial Beach, which straddles San Diego and Tijuana, what does the so-called border look like? A tall, imposing fence splits the coastline in two, but the beaches share a common natural history, native flora and fauna found nowhere else in the world. Dan Wattman is the principal organizer of a border garden near the beach. Here's an audio postcard about nature beyond fronteras.
This is the Binational Friendship Garden of Native Plants. The two main purposes of it are to promote the native flora of the region and to create a space where people can make friends and collaborate through the fence. The garden is half a circle here on the United States side. and then it completes over on the Mexican side. The 17-foot wall in the middle, the wall is made up of these tubes, and you can see through the tubes, and you can see the whole garden on both sides. I guess you can draw all kinds of metaphorical ideas from that, because there's this big, huge wall in the middle of this garden, and so it kind of symbolizes the idea of people making friends across barriers, I mean, in a literal way. This is what we call the mirror garden. So most of the plants are the same on both sides. We have a tory pine right there, and there's another tory pine on the Mexican side. And we have also these white sage plants. We planted them kind of in a zigzag across the border to mimic the Tijuana River, which goes back and forth across the border.
My name is Ana Munoz.
What are you digging here?
Just some weeds.
My name is Vianet Medina. I come every Sunday. Once we talk about what kind of fence we want, maybe we want a vegetable fence instead of the metal fence. I know that that's impossible, but we can imagine a lot of things staying here.
We have a pathway in the middle, a binational pathway that leads right up to the fence, and we have rocks there and magic markers so people can make a wish and write on a rock. We're not allowed to reach through the fence, but maybe I can read a few from here.
Let's see. Deseo que algún día todos lleguemos a ser iguales. Todos viviremos en el mismo lugar sin frontera. I hope that someday we'll all be the same and that we will live together without borders.
Our audio postcard from the U.S.-Mexico border was produced by Valerie Hamilton. And for this week, that's Latino USA. No sean malos! Friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or Tumblr, where we are Latino USA. All one word. Do it, por please, and muchas gracias. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Lita Hartman, Miguel Simon Jonsson, Andres Caballero, Diana Montaño, Daisy Rosario, and Michael Jones. We had production help this week from Milton Ruiz. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group in Harlem. The program was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Funding for our series, Radio Nature, is provided by the REI Foundation, supporting today's youth to develop a lifetime commitment to nature and the outdoors.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators. Hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring for the home handyman or building professional. More at lumberliquidators.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, whose commission to build a healthier America works to improve health, where Americans live, learn, work, and play. This is NPR.